Great to have you listening in here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. And, you know, here in Wisconsin, we are, I think, known for a wonderful collection of bakers. We bake in this state. We do a lot of baking. And the baking gets done the year round, certainly. It changes a bit over the seasons. But I think the heavy baking period is upon us. And we'll be through the next 2 months. And so it seems fitting to talk with our next guest today, Chris Kimball. Christopher Kimball has a new book out. It's called Milk Street Bakes. It is a lovely book, and it covers a whole, well, pretty much any area of baking you can think of, I think, is covered in this. Chris is founder of Christopher Kimball's Milk Street, a food media company dedicated to changing the way we cook. They produce a magazine, a radio, and a TV show. Chris is also the author of many books, including one I kind of like, Fanny's Last Supper. So as we talk with Chris, I hope you'll join in. Maybe let us know why you love baking, or what do you bake during this time of the year? Maybe you're struggling with a certain recipe that you'd like some help with. How can we help? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Christopher Kimball, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
Well, your book, which is just a lovely book. In fact, I don't have my own copy of it right now. I have Jill Nadeau's copy. And Jill Nadeau told me that I had better not lose this book. Perhaps it might find it. I think she thought it might find its way into my own collection of books. But this is a real dandy. And maybe just give us your thoughts on why you put this together and how it's put together.
Well, the concept is the same as Milk Street's idea. Travel the world, cook with people, mostly home cooks, have them teach you new ways of cooking, new recipes, bring them back, put them in our kitchen, adapt them to the American home kitchen. And then, you know, you end up changing the way you cook. Now, baking is particularly apt because the way people bake around the world is very different than here. You know, most cultures do flatbreads, for example. Not something we do very well here. A lot of baking in the rest of the world are things you have with a cup of coffee in the late afternoon, right?
Yeah.
Well, a lot of cultures don't actually do desserts like we do. So the kinds of things they bake are different. So, for example, in Crete, there's a broken phyllo cake. So you take phyllo rolled up, cut it into 1-inch strips, throw it in an oven for 15 minutes to dry it out, make an easy cake batter, throw the phyllo into the batter and put that into a pan and bake it. And the phyllo, there's no flour. The phyllo is the flour. And you get this amazing cake that has a sugar syrup that's soaked into it. So, you know, that's not something that I never heard about growing up in New England. So, you know, I couldn't even spell phyllo probably. So, you know, there's so much out there that's so interesting. The, you know, invisible cake where you take 4 or 5 apples and you slice them super thin and you make this cake that has like 1,000 layers because the apples are so thinly sliced. So it's just really fun to look at baking from a other point of view.
And you cover breads of all kinds. Pizza, pies and puddings, what else? Loaf cakes, small cakes.
Loaf cakes, you know, Claire Patak owns a bakery in East London. She did the royal wedding in 2017 or whatever. And one of her specialties are loaf cakes. So, you know, you make a caramel sauce, you put that at the bottom of a loaf pan, add some sliced fruit like peaches or whatever, put the cake batter on top, bake it, and then flip it upside down. And so you have this amazing, you know, fruit, you have the caramel sauce, you have the cake, and it's a one pan cake. It's not a multi-layer cake. So, you know, it's easy to do. So that's just another way of thinking about, you know, baking is it can be simpler, but it's really interesting.
Yeah. Mary in Wausau has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Such a privilege to talk to you. I've been a longtime fan. I make a strata for Thanksgiving. We do brunch just so all my other kids can go to the in-laws wherever they want, and the brunch is to work out for us. And so I put a lot of extra eggs and extra fillings in my strata. And how do I get the middle cooked properly without burning the edges? Just do I go lower and slower, or what would be your recommendations? And I add a lot of extra fillings like sausage, spinach, cheeses, everything.
Sounds good. What about that, Chris?
Yeah, if the center isn't getting baked before the edges, there are two things you can do. Use a light colored pan. Darker pans will definitely conduct heat to the outside more quickly. It makes actually a pretty big difference. And the second thing is definitely lower the oven, like put it in a 325 instead of a 375 or whatever. And that should help. Yeah.
Yeah. Mary, there you go. Good luck. It sounds great to me. And thank you for calling. Kelly emailed, they literally just took the chocolate and tahini babka from the latest issue of Milk Street out of the oven. Just did it. It's Kelly's first time making this bread, and they can't wait to try it later. So the chocolate and tahini babka.
Yeah, that's a great recipe. I mean, tahini is interesting because it wasn't really well known here till maybe 10 years ago. And now it's being used in lots of things. You can put it in, you know, peanut butter cookies. You can put it in brownies. You know, you can put it in lots of things. But with that recipe, it's just absolutely amazing. The thing I like about tahini is it gives you, obviously, a nutty, slightly savory base, which is really good when you have something sweet. You know, the problem with chocolate chip cookies, I mean, assume that anyone agrees there is a problem with chocolate chip cookies, which may be not true. But it's really nice to pair, you know, something, a little bit of savoriness. It's like, many bakers today are using a little bit of rye flour with the all-purpose. Mm-hmm. So in our chocolate chip cookies, we use a lot of rye flour with all-purpose, and rye is slightly bitter. And so it gives you, sweet and bitter. I mean, a lot of baking and cooking is about, you know, creamy and crunchy, sweet and sour, bitter, you know, et cetera, sweet. So having the contrast is really what great baking's about, I think.
Yeah. Kelly, thanks so much for that email. You can email in too, talk@wpr.org. That's the email address, talk@wpr.org. Or you can call us 800-642-1234. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. Did you learn a lot from writing this book and putting it together? Or what did you learn?
Never do a cookbook again. I don't know.
You've got over 200 recipes in it.
Well, first of all, let's be clear about who did the book. We have a team of people here, 7 or 8 people in the kitchen. I travel the world. My editor, JM, travels the world. So it's really a group effort. It's not just me. But the fun part for me, I'll tell you a quick story. I was in Coyoacan Market in Mexico City a few years ago. Early in the morning, it's kind of chilly out, it was dark, and we were waiting to set up to cook with a chef who had a restaurant there. And she served this cup of coffee with this corn cake, and it was a one-layer round cake. It was something between cake and cornbread, and I never had anything like it. And actually, it's made in a blender, the batter, and it was phenomenal. It was like this entirely new experience. It's kind of like a corn-flavored red velvet cake, I guess. Not too sweet. And it's that joy of discovery when you don't expect it. You know, it wasn't a recipe I was looking for. So for me, the answer to your question is, I've learned that I don't really know very much, and that, you know, I've been doing this over 40 years. You get to the point where you think like, well, I got this down. But the fact of the matter is, that's ridiculous. There's so much out there, and the surprises are almost always pleasant. I mean, it's just like, oh, I never thought of that. Another quick example is, I was in Mexico a different time, and we were cooking beans, and the chef made a sofrito, which is, you know, peppers and onion stuff cooked in a skillet, and he added it to the beans right before serving, instead of starting the recipe with a sofrito, right? And then, so he added it at the end, and I was like, well, why have I been adding it at the beginning? Because all those flavors, you know, instead of melding into everything else, they're fresh. And you could taste the garlic and the onion and the peppers and the chilies. So, yeah, it's that I learned so much. And that is my takeaway from this book is, you know, I've been a baker since I was 7 or 8 years old. And I just learned so much from doing this book.
Yeah. And you, you know, many people call baking a science. What's your thought, or maybe explain the thought behind that?
Well, I'm one of those people, for better or for worse. Yeah, there's science to it, because the pH of your batter, for example, will affect what kind of leavener you use, right? Baking soda, baking powder, both. You know, sugar attracts moisture. It's hygroscopic. But if you use honey, that's going to change the nature of the dish. And that's, you know, if you use vegetable oil instead of melted butter, like you do it in carrot cake, that's going to change the texture of the cake long term. So the kind of pan you use, the size of pan you use, some things are less finicky than other things. But you don't want to go messing around. Like people often say, well, I have this cake recipe, there's too much sugar in it, the 3 cups of sugar. And I go like, okay, but I'm going to cut it in half. And I'm going like, well, no, maybe cut it 20% to start, because it changes the chemistry. So yeah, there is a lot of chemistry. I think it shouldn't, the fact that there's chemistry shouldn't scare you.
Right.
It shouldn't make you not change things, but always make the recipe the way it was written the first time. And then once you've got a handle on it, then you can start messing around with it. But obviously you can mess around with a stir fry a lot more. It doesn't matter in a stir fry what you change, but it does matter, you know, in a Genoise, the slightest change can be disastrous.
Jackie in Chippewa Falls has something for us. Let's go there. Jackie, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share my experience with pie crust. I have made a good pie crust for many, many years. My mother taught me. I kind of do it by feel, but I always use Crisco. And for a while, I didn't bake pies. I just didn't have the need for it. And I went to bake a pie, and my crust wouldn't turn out well. And I was using my Crisco and my flour and my salt and my ice butter. I couldn't get it rolled out. Baking. And it would break. It would just chunk into breaking pieces. And I thought, this is just wrong. It's not stretchy. So I threw it back in the bowl, put a wet paper towel over the top of the crust, and put a lid on it, you know, good old Tupperware. And went and had a cup of coffee for about a half an hour, and I came back and took it, opened it up, and tried to roll it out, and it was absolutely perfect. Well, I called the company and asked them what had changed, and it was about the time that they had done something with whatever was unhealthy. I mean, it's all unhealthy, I guess, but they had done something with whatever was in there, and they changed it some. And so now I can make pie crust with Crisco again. And I also wanted to tell you about my accident pie. When I bake pies, when it gets fall time, I want an apple pie and I want a pumpkin pie. And so I make enough pie crust to make two crust pie and a one crust pie. So I did that, and I, for some reason, I don't know why, but I had extra pumpkin. I just you know, and that little piece of pie that I roll out and put butter and cinnamon sugar on in the oven and just eat it like cookies. No, that wasn't going to happen. So I took a little pie pan and I put that crust in there, and I had, oh, I don't think I had a cup and a half of pumpkin, but I stuck it in there, and I thought, well, that's not going to be enough in there. By the time your crust is done, your pumpkin's going to be rubber. So I had a wayward apple in there, so I peeled it and put some cinnamon in with the apple and put that in the pie and just kind of pushed it down into the pumpkin. Okay, we'll throw that in. It comes up a little higher. It's a little more filling, so okay, we'll cook it. That was the best apple pumpkin pie. Oh, it was so good.
Chris, Jackie brings up a couple of things, one relating to Crisco and the other relating to her apple pumpkin pie.
Yeah, Crisco, I mean, making a pie with Crisco, which I've done, it's easier to roll out, and it's not going to be, it'll be flaky. Butter, of course, has more flavor, but butter is a little harder to work with. So in general, and now they have the non-hydrogenated Crisco. So yeah, you can do that. The best thing, actually, the best thing to make a pie with is pork lard. And it's the lard from around the kidneys. And that stuff is amazing. It doesn't taste like pork at all. And one of my kids processed a couple of pigs a few months ago and made some lard for me. And so I keep that in the fridge. That's the best stuff. But butter is a little trickier. The two things people do wrong with pie crust, they don't cut the fat in enough to the flour. Recipes say pea-sized pieces. That's nonsense. Like, you really want to cut it in, because then the fat is covered with flour and there's less gluten development. The second thing is people are afraid of adding too much water to their pie dough, which means it ends up being dry and it's hard to roll out. So you're better off making sure you have enough water in it. There isn't that much gluten development in a pie dough anyway. The other last trick I'll leave people with is you can use half vodka and half water when mixing your dough. And most of that liquid in the vodka, the alcohol will burn off. So you have the benefit of a soft, malleable dough. But when it bakes up, it actually bakes up nice and flaky. So that's another trick.
Oh, some tricks of the trade from Chris Kimball. Christopher Kimball's latest book is titled Milk Street Bakes. It's a lovely book and covers baking in many areas and from many areas of the world, as a matter of fact. Join in with your own questions or comments. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking baking on the program right now with Christopher Kimball, and his latest book is titled Milk Street Bakes. Lovely book. Questions? Give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. And let's take a call from Laura in Portage. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I have a question about Sham Tort. I come from a family that used to make Sham Tort. My mother made Sham Tort in a spring mold, and like an angel food cake spring mold. And then her mother-in-law made individual Sham Torts. And once I tried making it, and it's just like egg whites, and it was real nice in the oven. And then, you know, it rose. And the next time I opened the oven carefully to look at it, everything had fallen. It was just a slimy liquid at the bottom. And before I die, I'd like to make Sham Tort.
Okay, Christopher.
Well, I don't know. Maybe it's a recipe you should make after you die, because it's a killer. I mean, it's meringue. You're cooking a meringue. And I know this is an old wives' tale, but it's true. It's humidity. Like, doing it in the summer if it's humid is just really tough. A lot of people, you do it at very low oven temperatures. Even turn off the oven and let it sit in the oven for another hour or two. It has to really dry out to form that structure. So It's like pavlova. It's really a similar thing, and you can fill it with berries and whipped cream, whatever. But it don't feel bad, because even professional bakers, if it's not a nice dry day and there's too much humidity, you're going to have a problem. But it's a lot of time in the oven, very low oven, and you really got to dry out the meringue. So, you know, it's one of those things. I guess it's a good life goal. It's as good as any other, but it ain't easy. Yeah, you're right.
When you say very low, what is very low?
Oh, you can do it at like 225 or 250, something like that. It's really and very often recipes will say turn off the oven and then close the door and let it sit. So you really want low and slow, because what you don't want to do is brown it. I mean, it should be nice and white, like, you know, a cooked meringue, but you want it to dry out. So you don't want too much heat. It also could be, it's one of those recipes where if your oven is not calibrated properly, you could have trouble as well, because you need the right temperature. So that's something you should check out.
Yeah, and I know my own electric oven is, it runs about at three, when it's 350, it's really 355. It runs about.
Well, mine is, when it's 350, it's about 375. So yours is more accurate than mine.
But but even 5 degrees makes a difference.
Yeah. Well, I think, look, you have to ignore every bit of timing in any recipe ever written. It's total nonsense. Like in an oven, as you said, like some ovens can be 350. If you set it 350, some ovens will be 310. Some will be 390. And on stovetop, medium, it depends on how many BTUs, British thermal units, your burner puts out. So like here in the office, we have a burner that, you know, it's like I got a candle under it. It has no power. And at home, I have a much more powerful burner. So medium here versus medium home is just the, you know, so you just forget times. Those are very rough ideas.
So times you kind of have to forget. But the thing on measurements, I think you need to be more precise, and you do talk about this in your book. You need to be more precise when it comes to amounts of various things.
Well, the first thing is, if you're baking, and that's what we're doing here today, you definitely need a scale, a digital scale. I mean, you can't bake effectively without it. If a recipe calls for a cup of flour, and you have 10 people measure a cup of flour, you know, you're going to get all sorts of different, you know, if 5 ounces, 4.5 ounces, 5.5 ounces, it depends how you compress the flour into the cup. So it's much better weighing, and it depends on which chart you use, but about 130 grams per cup for all purpose. And so that's really important. Now, in some recipes, like in a pie crust recipe, it doesn't really matter that much, but in a cake of some kind, then it really does matter. So weigh your ingredients.
And when it comes to, you mentioned flours, and when it comes to flours, you know, let's say you're making some bread, and I don't happen to have the bread flour, so I'm just going to use all purpose, and then it may not turn out at all like you like it. What is it? What are the differences among those flours?
You're a crazy man. You're going to use all-purpose flour instead of bread? You're living on the edge. That's great. A fearless baker. Yeah, the difference is gluten. I mean, there are two proteins in flour, glutenin and gliadin, to get into the science. And when in contact with water, they're able, it's sort of like spaghetti, you know, they sort of can join and wrap together and connect. And that creates gluten, which allows the bread to rise. It traps the gases created by the yeast. So in a bread flour, it's higher protein. There's more gluten and gliadin. You get more gluten development as opposed to all-purpose flour. So bread flour might be 14% protein. All-purpose flour, depending on the brand you get, is 10 to 11, a little higher for King Arthur. Cake flours are soft wheats, which have less protein, which are 8 or 9% protein. So
gluten is important. You can make regular bread. I mean, I kind of made fun of you, but you can make you can make bread with all-purpose flour. But you're probably not going to get the same kind of rise out of it. It's a little bit different, but you can do it.
Yeah, you and you don't get the same rise out of it. That's for sure.
And by the way, it's really, I buy really good milled flour. I mean, I think it's really important to get the good stuff if you're going to bake at home, because it's not much more expensive. And, you know, I think it makes a big difference.
Yeah. Eggs, you know, eggs come in different sizes, and you often see that recipes call for a certain size egg, you know, large egg, let's say. But there are even large eggs from one farm might be different than the large eggs from another farm. How do you cook accurately when it comes to eggs?
Well, yeah, you don't want to switch extra large for medium or whatever. That is a big difference. You can go back to what I just said, which is weigh your ingredients. An egg's about 2 ounces or so. So you can just weigh them, and that's the way to get around it. Now, it depends on the recipe. If you're making a cake and you're creaming, you're beating eggs with sugar, you know, probably doesn't make too much difference. But there are recipes where it would make a lot of difference. So I would weigh it, 2 ounces per egg.
You've brought a couple of recipes to share with us today, and they'll be linked on our episode note after the show is over. But they look lovely. First is a tomato olive focaccia. Which country inspired that bread?
Focaccia is Italian. It's a very high liquid bread. That is, if you weigh the flour and you weigh the water and divide the weight of the water by the weight of the flour, that's your hydration percentage, which simply means, you know, what percent of the bread is liquid. A lot of breads are 55 to 65% hydration. Focaccia gets up to 85 to 90%. And that's why you get the big holes, like in a pizza dough or in a focaccia. That's why you get that, because there's a lot of water in the dough. So focaccia is not hard to make. It's just a high hydration bread dough baked in a sheet pan. And so you can actually, I did a pizza dough where you don't have to stretch it out. You just let it rise. It's essentially focaccia dough. And it's very liquid. I mean, those doughs, focaccias, are hard to handle. They're really not, you don't really handle them by kneading them by hand. They're so liquidy. So you can make pizza that way as well. And you get a great pizza, but you don't have to actually stretch it. You pour it into the pan, and it's pour in the pan pizza. So it's the same thing as focaccia.
And that was, yeah, and that pizza was really intriguing to me, because you start with the, you know, what would be the toppings, and then you pour the crust, you pour the dough on over the top of the ingredients, you know, whatever it is you're using for toppings.
Yeah, you do a lot of upside down pizzas that way. You can cook them in a skillet, and it's sort of like doing, you know, tart tatin or something like that. It's the ingredients are at the bottom.
Grant emailed us, an avid bread baker 5 years ago or so. They came up with a very unique yeasted sweet corn bread. Uses super fresh corn that's cut from the cob and pureed. And the puree creates all the liquid in the dough.
Huh.
Much to Grant's surprise, it was included in the Dane County Farmers Market 50th year cookbook. Grant makes variations of it using pureed asparagus or pureed roasted tomatoes in place of the sweet corn.
Yeah, that's I like that idea. And I love using the milk from the corn, not the kernels. You can use a milker, or you can just take a knife and slice through and then take the back of the knife and get all that wonderful liquid out. And that's great for making corn puddings or corn souffles or cornbread. I'm not a big fan of kernels of corn in my bread. That completely freaks me out. I just like, I completely lose my mind. But I love the idea of using the liquid from the corn because it has a tremendous amount of flavor. So it sounds like a good idea.
Carol in Wanakee has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I have been a baker forever. In fact, it took me 6 tries to find the perfect cinnamon roll recipe. But a question that I have, because I've started to ask myself why I put the shelf in at the level that I do in the oven. Sometimes I have it right in the middle and sometimes the one above or the one below. And I understand it's going to have to do higher in the oven is going to be warmer, but are there other considerations?
Yeah, it's not really about that. It's about the top and bottom of what you're baking. For example, if you're baking a pie, you want it probably on the lowest rack because you want the bottom of that crust to bake up well. So if you have a glass pie dish, Pyrex pie dish, I would put it on the bottom rack because you really want to get that bottom crust cooked through. If you have something you're baking where you really want the top to get really well browned, you would put it on a higher rack. In general, you probably, like a cake or something, probably, because most ovens, the racks are not exactly in the middle, sort of on the rack that's at the bottom third. So the top of the cake's in the top third, something like that. That would be my go-to. But pies in particular do really well on the bottom racks. So,
Carol, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And Sally emailed us. She was happy to hear you speak to the accolades of using lard for pie crust. Sally's grandmother always used lard.
Yeah.
She shared her recipe with Sally, used it for years, and when they had access to an apple orchard and would make multiple pies for the freezer, crust was always perfect. She got out of the habit of using lard and struggled with good pie crust ever since, so she thinks she is now going back to the lard recipe.
Yeah, it's got to be leaf lard, though, because if you go to the supermarket and buy lard, it's going to taste porky. So you want to use leaf lard. Leaf lard is, as I said earlier, is the fat around the kidney. It doesn't have a bacony or porky flavor. It has a very neutral flavor. So that's what old time bakers used to use. And boy, there was a place in Vermont I went to years ago and they made all their pies there with leaf lard and flaky and light. And, it doesn't sound like it should work. But it's really, really, really good.
Well, can you go and buy, leaf lard somewhere? Or
I don't think you can buy in a supermarket. I think if you have a co-op, I shop at a co-op in Vermont where you could probably get it. You probably have to order it. But, it keeps nicely. And I have 4 big bottles of it in my fridge for my daughter. And so I'm all stocked now. But if you want to make the world's best pie crust, that's what you need to use.
John wonders, how can you tell that the dough is done rising?
It's pretty easy. You put your finger in it, and it should actually, I believe what should happen is the indentation should remain. The problem with rising, there are 2 problems. Everybody's kitchen's at a different temperature. So if you're trying to proof dough at 65 degrees, it really should be proof more like at 80 degrees. So it'll take a long time. The second thing that's a problem is people proof in a bowl, and it's hard to look to see if it's doubled. It's the geometry is a bit confusing. So you can get straight-sided plastic containers. King Arthur sells them, and they have markings. So, or you can mark it yourself. So one way around this is with a bowl, is to fill it with the amount of water that represents the volume of the dough you're going to put in, and then put in that same amount of water again and mark it on the bowl. Take a marker on the outside or a piece of tape. So even if it's if it's round sides, you'll know when you've doubled the dough. And the last thing I'd say is I bought a proofing box a couple years ago. Actually, we sell them, but they're a little expensive. They're plastic. They fold up. and you just put the bowl on a rack in this box, this plastic box. You plug it in and you can set the temperature for whatever you want. It's a godsend because everything proofs in exactly the right amount of time. You know, I woke up one morning in Vermont in my house and the kitchen was 52 degrees. So, like, you're not going to be proofing dough in a 55 degree kitchen. So if you make a lot of bread, I strongly recommend getting some kind of proofing box. You can turn your oven into a proofing box. That's a little tricky. You heat it up for 10 minutes on low and then turn it off. But a proofing box, or you can get these little pads you put the bowl on and they heat up. That also works pretty well. But temperature is really important.
Chris Kimball is our guest today. His latest book is titled Milk Street Bakes, a lovely book. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking baking today with Chris Kimball. Christopher Kimball's latest book is Milk Street Bakes. So questions for him about baking or maybe about the book, I hope you'll give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I mentioned that you had supplied us with a couple of recipes from the book. There was a cake, a chocolate cake, and it's made on the stovetop.
Yeah, this is, if you don't have an oven, this is a great cake. It's a cake, it's steamed, and you put it on a rack in, let's say, a Dutch oven or other big pot, and you essentially steam it in a cake pan. I believe it uses cocoa and not chocolate. And you get this incredible, light, velvety texture. And the chocolate is present, but it's not too, you know, problem with a lot of chocolate cakes, I know this sounds odd, they're too chocolatey, but it has a nice chocolate flavor, but it's not overpowering. So you put it in a regular cake pan, there's some water, there's a rack, put the top on, steam it. And it's absolutely, it's one of my favorite chocolate cakes. It's just really delicious.
And looks delicious in the book. By the way, the photography in your book is really good. It is really, really good.
And yeah, I think this, I really like the photos in this book. I mean, they're not fancy, but they're just really appealing.
Yeah, they are very appealing. And to me, a cookbook should have photos. I like to see sort of the final product or what it should look like.
Well, it's a good thing you weren't alive in the 1890s because Fanny Farmer didn't have a lot of pictures. She had a few black and whites, but that's about it.
Yeah. Oh man. So the cooking process is pretty simple for that.
Yeah. A lot of cakes, you know, when I grew up, you know, I did a lot of one bowl cakes, right? I just did one today, which was a sticky chocolate cake from Sweden. Again, one bowl cake, really easy to make. You know, I think no one does cakes better than Americans. I mean, I think our layer cakes are brilliant. Like a Southern coconut cake with four layers, you just die and go to heaven. It's just one of the great cakes. But the rest of the world, Europe, tends to do torts or one layer cakes, and they're much easier to do, and some of them are great.
You know, you often see espresso powder alongside cocoa powder in recipes like this cake, and also in brownies. How do these flavors complement each other?
Oh, I don't think you have a hard time with espresso or chocolate powder in chocolate. You know, coffee and chocolate obviously goes really well together. I think it's when you start adding some other things. First of all, salt. You know, a lot of old recipes don't call for salt in desserts, especially cakes. You absolutely need salt. That's really important. I think some bakers I know put in all sorts of herbs like rosemary in, or they put other stuff. And sometimes that works and sometimes that doesn't. It depends on the mix. But salt's important. Espresso or coffee powder really helps out a lot. Molasses goes really well. I'll go back to something I said earlier. Having something that's not bitter, but something that offsets sweetness, I think is a really nice idea. Because if I were to say anything about English desserts, where a lot of our cooking came from, at least at one time. It was sweet on sweet, right? It was just a lot of sugar. So I think, as I said, using a little rye flour in place of some of the all-purpose, it just adds that extra dimension. I think that's what makes a great dessert.
Kathy in Madison has a question, so let's go there. Hi, Kathy.
Hello. Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is about using butter or oil in cake recipes. And I have some recipes I like, and it's one is all butter, but the cake ends up too dense, and I was hoping to be able to substitute with it some oil, but I don't see if that would make it a little bit less dense. But I don't think the amounts are equal because butter has liquid in it. And I was just hoping for a little more information.
Well, I'd have to ask you a question. The butter you use, is the butter getting creamed in the recipe with sugar or just being added melted, or how's the butter treated?
It's usually creamed with the sugar.
Yeah, well, that substitution is not going to work because the butter, when it's creamed, air is whipped into it and it becomes light, as you know. And that helps aerate and create the light texture of the cake. If you just use vegetable oil, obviously that's not going to, incorporate air, and you'll get a denser cake. The one reason, though, in place you can use oil in cakes is like a carrot cake, right? Or an olive oil cake or whatever. What happens is butter tends to give you a drier texture. Oil, it gives you a very moist texture. And the cake, like a carrot cake, will last longer. 3 days later, you still have a moist slice of cake versus butter. So, another one is chiffon cake uses some oil. So I love oil in cakes. I think it's great. But if you're creaming butter and sugar, you can't substitute oil. That's just going to change the texture.
Yeah. Kathy, there you go. Thank you. Another Kathy, this one in Middleton. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how you doing, Larry?
Good. I appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Well, I have changed my lifestyle dramatically, and I want to keep it that way. I am cooking more for one and two. I no longer have dinner parties. I don't want to. I don't want to have this fuss, this muss, this measuring, this mixing, this chopping, this pureeing, all of these small garbage appliances that the TV shows tell you you got to have or you're not going to have a decent life. So what I use primarily is an Emeril oven that I bought a few years ago. I can't say I'm really happy with it, but I'm not necessarily unhappy with it. How do I use it to the best of its ability?
So it's like a toaster oven, you're saying?
Well, it's supposed to do everything under the sun except to, slice bread.
Emeril, an Emeril toast oven is what you're talking about. Okay.
Yeah, the stovetop ovens, depending on how big they are, yeah, some of them can do a chicken pretty well. You can bake in it, do a lot of stuff. There's nothing wrong with that. You're not going to do huge batches of things, but a loaf cake, for example, a pound cake, you can do a lot of stuff. You can do small batches of cookies. Yeah, they're and a lot of people now make, Breville makes them, a lot of people make them. You certainly can do that. I mean, I'm going to push back a little bit on you because you don't, you want to cut back on the mess and everything else. I think it's how you cook. I remember in the 70s I'd have a dinner party on Saturday and I cook all Friday night and I get up early Saturday and, I bake. It was just a mess. 15 hours of baking and this and that. I just don't do that anymore. Like if I have people over occasionally, I'll make two things. I'll make a pot of soup or stew, main thing, throw together a salad, which takes 2 minutes. And then I'll make some simple dessert. I actually had a friend of mine over who's a chef in Boston, and we did hot dogs and hamburgers, And I made some homemade ice cream, but that was about it. So I just think if you don't want the mess and the fuss, and I totally understand you, just create a menu that's like one thing. Like make a bowl of soup and buy some bread and you're done. And a glass of wine, I don't think people are going to be happier with the more things they get. Just give them one thing and make a salad and get a glass of wine and have a loaf of bread. And, you know, and then it's done. You could do it the day before. So it might be just a how you manage your menu that might make it easier for you. But anyway, the stovetop ovens do work.
Kathy, thank you for calling. And Joseph emailed us. He would like to bake fresh bread for his wife who doesn't eat gluten, but he really struggles with gluten-free conversions. Any suggestions?
Well, yeah, there are, you know, there are a few companies that make a one-for-one gluten-free flour. They use rice flour and, you know, corn flour and everything else, cornstarch and et cetera. If you're making bread, an American loaf or a rustic, you know, European loaf, those are the hardest things to do gluten-free. You're just not going to get the texture. My strong suggestion is get a cookbook that's specifically designed for gluten-free bread baking, because one size does not fit all. I've done this many times. I did a gluten-free book 15 years ago, and it turned out that every recipe was a little different, especially when it comes to breads. Like, for example, you're doing a bread baked in a loaf pan. One of the problems was it would rise up just over the sides of the pan into the oven. So there are all sorts of problems. So I think for a cookie, you know, you can get away with it with a one-for-one gluten-free flour substitution. But bread, because it's so dependent on gluten, you know, is something you'd have to go buy a book that's really focused on that.
Yeah, it makes sense. You mentioned pans, and sometimes it just bothers me. You know, you're baking something, and it'll say a 9x5 pan, and I've got a 9x13 pan.
Right.
Drives me nuts. You do address that in your book.
The first thing you want to do is figure out the, you know, multiply the length by the width and figure out where you are. The problem is it's going to completely change the baking. If you have an 8-inch cake pan versus a 9-inch cake pan, it's going to change the baking times. And you may have to actually lower your oven a little bit for the 8-inch pan to make sure the center gets cooked properly. So messing around with sizes can be a little dicey. You know, pizza is not a problem, but any cake, the cake pan's going to make a big difference. As I said, dark pan versus light pan is also a really big change.
Yeah, it is indeed. What's your favorite baked good to eat?
Well, it really is apple pie, because in the old days, people used 3 or 4 different varieties of apples. And in the old days, apples actually had flavor. I find a lot of the new varieties are super sweet. But, you know, they like sheep's nose and all these other things, pippin, and they had not a savory flavor, but they had a really interesting flavor to them. And so making apple pie with different apples that has a great crust, when you get that right, this is the time of year where you can go find some of those apples. It is an extraordinary dish, but it's not just a bunch of, it's not sweet on sweet. It has more complexity to it. So I think if I was going to hire someone as a baker, that would be the test. Like, can you make a good apple pie? Because it's not easy.
And on that note, Chris, I want to thank you so much for taking an hour to be with us today to talk about baking and to talk about your wonderful book. It's a beauty. Milk Street Bakes is the title. And, Chris, I hope we can do it again. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Have a good Thanksgiving.
You as well. Well, and I want to thank you for joining us today. You know, all of our shows are kind of a team effort. Our producers are Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod. Our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I am Larry Mueller, and I thank you so much. It was a fun show today. A couple of great segments and topics with some great people who know what they are doing. And you know what? I bet right through the afternoon that you'll be hearing from a lot of people who know what they're doing, and I stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.